Welcome to the Work, Wealth, and Travel Podcast. I'm your host, Nicole, and this podcast is your guide to start creating a lifestyle by design. From entrepreneurship, money and finance, taxes and residencies, and everything in between, this show highlights the nuances of a true global citizen lifestyle. Let's dive in. Welcome back to the Work, Wealth, and Travel Podcast. In today's episode, I sit down with Vance from My Latin Life. Since 2014, My Latin Life has been your trusted guide to traveling and living in Latin America. In this episode, we chat all things residency programs within Latin America, specifically in Paraguay. We talk about what banking and investing looks like as a global citizen, and what it looks like moving from a digital nomad into a truly diversified global citizen life, where not all of your money or assets is in only one country. We also dive into the lifestyle perspective, meeting community on the road when you are traveling and when you are gaining different residencies and/or citizenships across the globe. So let's dive right in. Vance, welcome to the Work, Wealth, and Travel Podcast. So I'm so interested to dive into your international global citizen digital nomad lifestyle and what that lifestyle by design looks like for you. You run My Latin Life, helping other global citizens to get residencies, citizenships, and the whole nine yards, especially throughout Latin America. So Vance, let's kick it off. If you don't mind sharing a little bit about how you got into this space and what your expertise is.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, there's definitely parts that don't get revealed as a semi-anonymous character. And part of the reason is I think that there's a little bit of Vance in everyone, right? Like everyone has this sort of James Bond side to them where they want to go out there and speak multiple languages and collect multiple passports and all that. So we like a little bit of mystery. But the origin story was really around escaping winter. And after reading the 4-Hour Workweek, so I read the 4-Hour Workweek quite early on, actually before Tim Ferriss's second book even came out. The second book was The 4-Hour Body. And I read The 4-Hour Workweek before The 4-Hour Body even came out, because I remember he was talking about like the book launch process on his blog and stuff. So this must have been 2009, give or take. So I kind of had a roadmap to geo-arbitrage, making money online, leveraging virtual assistants, being able to live places around the world and go outside the box. So I did continue, speaking of the box, I did continue checking boxes, you know, doing the things that you're supposed to do, getting degrees and working normal jobs. But it was always in the back of my mind to, and it was always like the secondary goal to prepare myself for being an early digital nomad or someone that could make money online. So I learned technical skills, computer skills, software skills, and at some point kind of quit my professional job and said, you know what, I think I can make a go of it making money online, and did it, and haven't looked back since. But yeah, so 4-Hour Work Weekend, escaping winter, which as a Canadian, I'm sure you can understand.
Yes, very harsh winters in Canada. So starting your journey quite a few years back, which I love, what did that look like? You had some skills, you were prepared to work online, maybe you found a remote job. What did the job landscape, entrepreneurial landscape, slash building up your residencies and knowing that you wanted to leave your home country look like?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the job landscape at the time, kind of in the 2010s, was that everyone either wanted to go into finance or to Silicon Valley. You know, Facebook IPO'd, and then the Facebook movie came out. We had the Great Recession in 2008, 2009. And so after that, all ambitious people at Ivy League schools and the good Canadian schools, they all wanted to go work in finance or work in tech, right? And so that was kind of the traditional opportunity set that people had, I guess, like 10 years ago. I'm not sure if that opportunity set is slightly different now, but it's probably like mostly the same, except now you have crypto and remote work is a lot more available. And so what I kind of noticed back then is I would go check out Wall Street and Bay Street and visit people that I knew working in the industry, both in the US and Canada. And it was definitely very stodgy. And I noticed when I went to Silicon Valley and got to hang out with like tech bros and go to those like beer and pizza type events, that everything was just much more fun and chill. And so I just kind of remember being like, wow, this is a much more, I guess you could say, accepting or fun environment than finances. But I'm certainly passionate about both, but just from like a chill perspective. Like I remember one time I went to like a event at a bank and I wasn't wearing a blazer and everyone was like staring at me. But anyway, so that would not happen in Silicon Valley, right? You kind of wear anything you want there. And so that kind of started putting me more on a path towards tech. And pre-2020, it was a lot more difficult to work online. So now, like Skype is pretty good, Microsoft Teams is pretty good. We're using Riverside to record. All this stuff is pretty good. But in 2015, 16, 17, like Skype barely worked. Like the video stuff barely worked. Maybe an audio phone call worked. I mean, it was still pretty early days. And so I kind of realized that if I wanted to work online, there was a much more limited number of skill sets that would get you there. And it was basically like computer skills. Like there were some people that were teaching English, obviously, or they were, which I think you did as well, right, in China. People were writing a little bit, like writing, like, I don't know, technical manuals or who knows what. But I'm like, that's never going to make any money. And so the only way to do it was really computer skills and getting really good with computers, learning how to code or doing something technical. So that's kind of the path I decided to take, was just get good at computer skills. And worked in offices for a couple of years doing computer stuff. I'm purposely not specifying exactly what my computer skill set is, but I worked in offices for a couple of years and then said, like, you know what, I'm good enough. I can work online, and the rest is history.
Awesome. I love that. I love the proactive thinking before it was, before I'm sure almost nobody was talking about it. Maybe Tim Ferriss was, but nobody else in the online space, especially in the in-person space in Canada of all places. I'm sure nobody was living that lifestyle. So I love the forward thinking there and the intentional lifestyle design. So what did it look like? Where did you go first? I'm assuming like a Mexico or something pretty easy, but then what did the journey to leaving the Canadian residency system look like for you? And then being like, oh, I actually have to leave this. I have to get another residency. What was that process like?
It was definitely very intentional. It was definitely like a multi-year thought out process. I am somewhat open that I'm a US Canadian dual citizen. So I kind of had that option there, because at the time that we're talking about, like mid 2010s, working remote was get it was certainly more advanced in the US than it is in Canada, and that's probably true to this day, where almost no Canadian company back then would allow that, except under very unique circumstances. But a lot of US companies were starting to be open to the idea of remote work. And so I said, and I was actually in Canada during part of the 2010s. And I said, you know what? We're going to switch everything over to the States. We're going to leave the Canadian tax system. We're going full States, switch my stuff to a zero tax state, one of those Florida, Texas, whatever, and got a remote tech job. And the plan worked really, really smoothly. And so I'm very comfortable with the foreign earned income exclusion and these sorts of things, because I was doing it before people were even talking about it. Like, I remember when I started looking this up on Google, particularly the foreign income exclusion. I can't speak today, but there was like no information online. There was like this one blog called Go Curry Cracker. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. It's like an early personal finance fire blog.
They helped me go to China. Not helped me, but they were a big inspiration.
There you go. So there was that one, and there was like very few others. Johnny FD had some stuff on his blog about the FEIE, and there really was not that many sources. There were not YouTube videos about it. I was like, is this even real? Like, I'm kind of taking a chance here. I'm like, okay, so I'm just going to spend, you know, 11 plus months outside the US, and I'm not even sure if this is like a real tax benefit. But I did it and I applied for it and or claimed it, and it ended up working. And then, so yeah, now more people have figured it out. But back then it was like, I don't even know if this is a thing.
Well, I assume there was hopefully the IRS website, and I'm sure you hired an accountant. So I guess they probably would have known what that looked like as well.
I think I was just using TurboTax.
Okay. So very straightforward. Okay, cool. So what was your first residency that you got? Clearly on the tax side, it's a little bit different, but what was the residency options? And I know it's changed a lot.
Yeah. So the way I kind of got into the residency and passport stuff was actually looking at the by descent stuff first, because as a US Canadian citizen, I was kind of like aware of this idea of passports by descent all my life, because I was, you know, traveling back and forth, visiting family and spending time in both countries. Like I said, Canadian American dual citizen. I have Canadian family, American family, and I have family that, even brothers and sisters, that they were entitled to one, but they only had the other. Like, some of my family only had the Canadian passport, some only had the American passport, but a lot of them could get both. I'm like, why don't you just get the other one? And they're like, I don't see the point, because no one really saw the point back then, or, you know, before 2020. So that kind of put me on the path, because I was the one basically handling all the paperwork for my family, getting like the US Canada stuff figured out, helping family members do it. And then, you know, that got me on Google and looking at some of these things. And I'm of European descent, so I started looking at like what European programs could I potentially get. Maybe my descendants are from like four or five countries. Like, maybe I can get like one or two of them. You know, so I started looking at like all these different ones. Like, okay, like how far can we go back? And you know what I mean? Like, can I get Scottish? Oh no, they only go like one generation back. Like this and that. But long story short, I ended up getting two different European citizenships for my family via descent. I'll kind of, I guess, keep those secret which two they are. But we got two for my family, which is huge. So we're already, just by looking at the descent, we're already up to four passports: U.S., Canada, and the two European passports. And then by, you know, this took years. Like, one of them was pretty fast. The other one took years and years and years. And I had to I visited these consulates a million times. I went to all the vital records office and the archives office. And I went to the apostille offices in person. And I drove to Ottawa like 7 hours. And I did all these different things. You know what I mean? So, I was really hands-on with doing these things, and this was back like years and years ago. And so I really got a lot of hands-on experience handling residency and citizenship applications for my family, and working with a bunch of different countries and all the document collection. And I learned a lot about genealogy too, and have gone on to like visit long-lost cousins in Europe and stuff. But anyway, and then so that put me on a path to looking at the residencies in Latin America. And, you know, I don't know if it was like, you know, escape artist or sovereign man was an early influence as well. Nomad Capitalist was starting to come out, but this was even like before Nomad Capitalist. This was like Sovereign Man days. And, you know, just reading those articles, and back then it was, more about like Chile. They love Chile, and trying to think what other countries they used to love.
Like a safe quote unquote country.
Yeah, they like Chile. They like Uruguay. Trying to think what else, but it was definitely like a different opportunity set of countries back then for residencies. But I started looking at the residencies and I fell into Paraguay and fell into like, oh, super easy, 5K in the bank, fly down there, instant PR. And long story short, I did Paraguay as my first residency. I was already traveling Latin America and I was already doing some digital nomad stuff. So maybe I kind of screwed up the sequence to the listeners, but my first LATAM residency was Paraguay.
And why Paraguay as the first one? Just because it was so straightforward?
Yeah, just because it was very easy. It just like made the most sense. It was like, okay, like there's really no qualifications, 5K in the bank, instant PR. Okay, let's do it. You know, reached out to some facilitators and stuff and did it. So I guess for context, this was long enough ago that I'm more than eligible for Paraguayan citizenship. And that'll hopefully be coming soon.
Awesome. Okay, so before we dive in, I want to ask about the business and what that trajectory has looked like. But since we're on the topic of Paraguay, let's talk about Paraguay, Asuncion, some of the other big quote-unquote cities. What do you think about Paraguay? Would you live there? Is it just somewhere that you travel? A lot of listeners are interested in Paraguay and some potentially have not been to Paraguay before.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess people are listening to the audio. I'm actually wearing a Paraguay Selección soccer jersey just because I knew I was talking to Nicole and she has a Paraguay connection herself. So I just thought it'd be funny. But I personally like Paraguay a lot. Like it's changed a lot though, because I went most recently a couple months ago, like late 2023. When I first went like 5 years ago, it was a very different place. When I first went 5 years ago, I was literally the only gringo. Literally, like, but to be fair, even when I went to Mexico 5 years ago, I was the only gringo. And even to this day, depending where I am in Mexico. But in any case, Paraguay was very different 5 years ago. Like the mall was a lot newer. The Shopping del Sol and the other one, Galleria, they were like much newer. And so that area was like more up and coming. And there was actually the Centro was less of a no-go zone and there was actually more activity in the center. Like it was actually more like somewhat evenly distributed in terms of like the bars and I don't know, stuff like that, like where people actually used to spend more time downtown. Whereas I feel like now in 2024, most people don't even go downtown. It's like by all accounts, it's gotten like a little bit more sketchier, a little bit more homeless and stuff like that. And all the nice areas where you want to be is around the malls. So that's kind of changed a little bit. But overall, I love Paraguay. Like I've really tried to dive into the, you know, learning about the culture, the history, this type of thing. And I really do like it. I think it's like a really unique place in a lot of ways. You know, I've read a lot about the Paraguayan War for independence, the Triple Alliance War. So I know quite a bit about that kind of context and how Paraguay kind of came to be a nation. I think really Paraguay has a lot going for it in terms of, you know, how it's like sitting on that water aquifer and it's got the dam so it can do the electricity and it's a food exporting nation. So they're self-sustaining and it just really has a lot going for it. In a lot of ways.
Definitely one good place for a plan B, that's for sure. I personally get a little bit antsy in Paraguay after a few months' time, but you know, there's a few big cities, so you can travel to and from a little bit. So, okay, so talk to me about my Latin life. What has the expansion of that looked like over the years?
Happy to. Before we do, maybe I wanted to, before we get off this, because we probably won't come back, they used to call Paraguay, I don't know if you knew this, they used to call it the Inland China in the 1800s. Because I know you study in China, so I'm trying to make a random connection. But they called it the Inland China because it was run by a dictator or a series of dictators. There was Mariscal Lopez, and there was even a guy or two before that. I should have brushed up before here. But because they were actually like a completely independent, rich nation because of the yerba mate exporting. And so they used to have like a monopoly on exporting yerba mate. And that basically made them rich. And they had like, what would you call it? It was sort of like China, where they were exporting, but they wouldn't really allow a lot of imports, and they wouldn't really allow a lot of European cultural influences and so forth. But for one reason or another, it was called the Inland China. And, you know, Argentina wanted this territory, Brazil wanted this territory. Paraguay used to have more territory than it does now, actually. It used to extend more towards the east and the south. And they really did a good job, a really honorable job of sort of defending this territory that could have easily been swallowed up by Brazil. There's a lot of these like subplots too, because Brazil was backed by the British crown. And then Paraguay was sort of backed by the Americans, because America had just recently, you know, gone independent from Britain. And America was sort of somewhat defending these like independent nations in Latin America to basically like reduce European colonial influence. But Brazil and Britain had a very close relationship. Like before Sao Paulo became a city, the real port there was Santos, which is in Sao Paulo state. Santos still exists today as like a shipping port. And that was really the big city. And they decided to build Sao Paulo, which was nothing more than a small village, because Santos is at ocean level, and it was just the malaria and the mosquitoes and stuff like that. And Sao Paulo has a decent elevation, so it's a more moderate climate. Anyway, and then long story short, the British financed the first railroad from Santos to Sao Paulo and they did that because the coffee was grown in the interior. And so the British built the railroad to get access to the coffee market so that the coffee could be exported from Santos back to Europe. Where was I going with this? Anyway, so like there's this sort of like sub narrative of Paraguay about how it was really, they were not just fighting Brazil. They were really fighting like the entire European monarchy for survival. And then you guys know what happened in the Paraguayan War. Probably they lost like 90% of the male adults. And then that kind of influenced the Paraguayan story about how Paraguay was a country that was really built by the women, because it was like 90% women. And so the women from Paraguay to this day are very strong and very, I don't know, savvy, I guess. And that has like a historical connection.
Are you interested in becoming a global citizen and living a lifestyle by design in a country that aligns with you? If this is a lifestyle that you're seeking to create, we can help. Whether it be multiple residencies, citizenships, bank accounts, trust or company formations, we operate in 30 plus of the most tax-friendly jurisdictions around the globe to get you structured properly. Head to the link in the show notes to learn more and to get your global citizen journey underway today.
Yeah, I love that little history lesson. Thanks for that. But yeah, if you are listening and you're going to be going to Paraguay at some point in the future, we did quite a few tours when we were there because the history is just so interesting. And I think, you know, coming from most countries, quite honestly, especially not within Latin America, you hear of Brazil and Argentina and sometimes Chile and Colombia, definitely Panama, but Paraguay, Uruguay, so much history and something that you don't really hear that much about. And mm-hmm. When you're on the ground in the country and you're at the places where it happened, it's just another level.
Yeah, and Asunción was also, it's called the La Ciudad Madre or La Madre de las Ciudades because Asunción was founded in like the 1500s by the Spanish. And then the entire interior of South America was really founded by conquistadors that left from Asunción and went on to found, Santa Cruz de la Sierra, Bolivia, and all these different cities in the interior of South America. Even Buenos Aires was actually founded by colonials from Asunción, because there was two foundings of Buenos Aires. There was there was a first founding, and the city only lasted like 10, 15 years. I kind of forget if there was a fire or natives or what happened there. And then what happened was after the first founding of Buenos Aires collapsed, they all went up to Asunción, and then they joined their other compatriots in Asunción, consolidated, and then I don't know, like 50 years later or something, they came back to Buenos Aires, and there was the second founding of Buenos Aires. So that's a historical connection why Asunción and Buenos Aires are so tightly linked today.
Yeah, I love that. So interesting. So let's chat about what has the trajectory, my previous question of what has the trajectory of the business looked like?
Yeah, trajectory of the business. Well, really, it's really in constant evolution. So I think anything I say will probably be outdated by about a year from now. But we're really morphing into a full-scale immigration consulting service. We can already handle residencies in every single country in Latin America, from Mexico to the Dominican to anywhere in Central America, anywhere in South America. We can handle basically any country, and we're really all about kind of helping Canadian, American, and European families either relocate to Latin America or to create a plan B. Some people are already fed up enough now that they're down to full out relocate, and some people are just kind of seeing the, what do you call it, seeing what's on the horizon in terms of, increasing like tyranny and this and that, and how the nation states in North America and Europe are really kind of like, they seem to be like fraying at the edges in very significant ways. And so some people are just kind of still down with the idea of staying there, but they may, for one reason or another, kids in school, whatever it is, but they want the plan B. So whether you're relocating or plan B, that's like the general archetype of people. But yeah, it's like full scale immigration consulting and relocation services.
Love that. Yeah, it's so interesting to see the trajectory of people because I find some people they just want to get out and they want many options, not just a plan B, but some people want to stay, but they know where the trajectory is going. They can see it, and so they want to get started on those backup options now, not necessarily use them, but have some options in the back pocket. So, you and I did a podcast. I was in Paraguay, so that was probably about 3 months ago now. And we dove into the back end of what my banking and investments and retirement looks like. So I'm curious what that looks like for you. Of course, you're tied to the US, so it's going to look a little bit different for you, but I'm curious living a very global lifestyle, what banking, retirement options, what that has looked like for you and investments.
Yeah, definitely. I guess shout out to we have our podcast, the My Latin Life podcast as well, 150 plus episodes. Nicole, after you listen to your second appearance, did you go back and re-listen to it just to check if you were like giving away too much sauce?
Honestly, I can never listen to any podcast that I record. Once it's done, I will never listen to it again. I feel like some people, they love hearing their voice and they want to listen again and again. And some people, I just can't listen to my voice again.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Well, it's definitely a good one. So I encourage people to listen to it. So I guess to address your question directly, how do I handle my stuff? I would say definitely the majority of my money and assets and investments are in the US. I think that's actually a great strategy for Americans, because the US is like largely a black box where, you know, if you're an expat living in Latin America or elsewhere, it does make sense to do similar to what I'm doing and just leaving a lot of your money in the States, because it's kind of a black box, and other nations for the most part can't even like pierce that veil and look into the US. But I do, of course, have some investments in money and bank accounts outside the US. I think that that's obviously very important. So I have a Paraguay bank account that I use pretty on a weekly basis, because I have to pay my Paraguayan lawyers. I have some passive income assets in Paraguay. And then what's funny is like people will pay me in US dollars for my Paraguayan residency services. And then I pay my Paraguayan lawyers with money generated in Paraguay from my passive income there. And so it's like kind of a funny thing. I don't have anything in Canada anymore, which you might be curious about. So I basically have like nothing in Canada anymore. I think I have, you know, one or two bank accounts with very little money, and one or two credit cards with very little activity, just to kind of like have it open. And, you know, e-transfer in Canada, for anyone that doesn't know, is like pretty baked into the Canadian social fabric. So you don't want to lose e-transfer. It's like kind of how we like send money to our buddies and stuff in Canada. So it's good to maintain Canadian bank accounts for that. But that's pretty much all I have it for, is like e-transferring Canadian buddies. So really mostly the US, and then some expansion to Latin America and more expansion to come, because I think that's kind of the part of the stages of progress from being like a digital nomad to an expat to like a more solid expat, is you start getting more involved in the local communities, or you start buying property and making local investments and stuff like that. So I'm kind of like entering that next stage, if you will, where I'm kind of moving past being a digital nomad into like a more long-term expat that's going to have more presence in Latin America.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. And it's so interesting to me because, of course, being American, you're always tied to that system. So when you asked me, I think my answer was the whole hour-long podcast, because what I described in your podcast, and go check it out, My Latin Life, if you haven't already, it's what I like to call is it's playing the game, because I am not American, so I'm not in that system for the most part, personally. And I need to get out of the Canadian system for the most part because I'm no longer a resident. So you really have to figure out these workaround options. Whereas the disadvantage of America is that you're tied to America, but the advantage is that you are tied to America. So you have that advantage to a degree. Now, what I assume your investments are for the most part in the US?
Yeah, most of my stuff's in the US. It's, you know, probably nothing groundbreaking. It's just kind of what makes the most sense for Americans. It's just America has, you know, you get the 5%, or even right now I'm getting 5.5% return on cash with Wealthfront. So that's pretty chill, and pretty boring stuff for the most part, you know, ETFs and this and that. But yeah, mostly US, but obviously it's important to have a significant portion outside the US as well, just for diversification purposes.
And I assume when you can, you would open up additional bank accounts. So Wise potentially in a different country, or any of these fintech banks, or a Zappo, if possible, you would open up just for diversification.
Yeah, definitely. I think I have a harder time. I find like I have a pretty easy time opening bank accounts. Maybe I have better luck than other people, but I have a hard time maintaining them and having them not friggin' deactivate, because they're so – Latin American bank accounts can be very annoying to log into, where it's like, oh, I have like – you got to have this like token, and then it takes 2 minutes to load, and you know, you really should be having like some activity every single month, or it'll sort of disactivate or go into like a hibernation state. So that's probably one thing I need to tune up. Like I definitely have bank accounts in like 5+ countries. But you know, I definitely have bank accounts in 5 countries or maybe like 3 countries that are also deactivated just from like that I need to like call their customer service or something.
Yeah, I find if I have a bank account, I'll probably have a SIM card and then I'll keep like, it's just like, I'm sure you have this, a pile of SIM cards and they're so tiny, you have to not lose them. And so then I'll pay them from that bank account, which is nice because it's like $10 and it'll keep it open. Mm. Where, if you don't mind sharing, do you have some of these bank accounts where, you know, pretty standard to open an account for someone if you're a resident or maybe even if you're just a tourist?
Yeah. You know, shameless plug, we can help people, non-residents, open bank accounts in like 4 or 5 different countries, Uruguay, Panama, Peru, Costa Rica. So there's that. How do I answer this question? I mean, in Mexico, there's one called Intercam that's really good that you can open as a resident even without an RFC, and you don't have to put in a whole bunch of money. So Intercam is pretty good, Intercam. So I recommend that one. So I have one of those. I think it's deactivated though, because even though I'm like in Mexico most of the year, or a lot of the year, I don't really use Mexican bank accounts. But it is a good one though, for sure. In Paraguay, I have 3 or 4. I have the Ueno. I don't even know how to pronounce it. Ueno. I think that one's like probably the best one in terms of the software and the user interface and stuff like that in Paraguay. I have Atlas Bank in Paraguay, which is pretty good. And then it's not the best, but it's all right. And then I have Familiar in Paraguay as well. That one might even be like disactivated or something because that one's kind of annoying to log into. But those are like the big 3 I have in Paraguay. I think you know, there are certain banks in Paraguay where you can open with just a cédula, basically, or just a cédula and a RUC. And then there are other banks where you really need to have like at least 6 months of tax returns and ideally some sort of ingresos, like some sort of money that you make in the country. And then you can get the Itaú and maybe like for the other ones, Banco General or whatever, maybe that's Panama, but like there are other ones in Paraguay that you can get if you have more activity as well. But honestly, I found them pretty good, especially because they do have low limits, which I know you've talked about on your podcast, like how you can only like bring in like roughly $1,000 a month into these bank accounts. But if you have 3 of them, that's $3,000, like I don't know. And then you can get it raised after a while, like after you've had it open for 6 months or a year or so.
And in Paraguay, $3,000, like you're living real good.
Yeah, there you go. And you can even, for the listeners, there's at least one bank that you can get where you can get a Visa Infinite card, which would give you lounge access to Priority Pass. Which is a huge, huge benefit. So, you know, for non-Americans that might normally not have access to VIP lounges and stuff like that, I'm starting to notice that a lot of LATAM countries are starting to get these Visa Infinite cards that'll give you Priority Pass. So that we have banks where that would be possible in Panama and Paraguay. And I'm sure there's many others as well.
Yeah, definitely other countries are wanting to join the party, I guess, so to speak. So one of my last questions for you is surrounding community. You know, living this lifestyle, I know you've been in one place for a while now, but when you travel or when you are traveling throughout mm-hmm. one country, what does building a community of like-minded global citizens, entrepreneurs, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, I've never had problems with loneliness. It's never even like crossed my mind. Like I do hear the complaint from time to time from my clients or people in our Telegram groups and stuff like that. I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like Latin America is way more fun and it's way easier to make friends here. I'm more lonely when I go back to Canada, the US, and it's like impossible to get like seven people together for a dinner back in Canada, because I don't even know, people just love declining invitations to things. So I feel like without a doubt, the social life is way more poppin' in Latin America, both among bros that are down to hang out, and then obviously from a dating perspective, in terms of also like joining leagues. I find just like joining leagues is a lot easier in Latin America, whether you want to play like tennis or soccer or basketball, you can basically just like rock up and like join a league and stuff. Whereas I found there's like more bureaucracy doing that in Canada, the US, and it's like, oh, you missed the enrollment window and like all this crap. And it's like way more expensive. So, I mean, I bounced around a lot, but you know, whether I'm in a digital nomad hub or more of like a off the beaten path tier B type city, I've really like never experienced loneliness or lack of community or anything like that. I think if people really, really want to optimize for community, the best thing to do is, well, I have a lot of thoughts on this, but I'll give you one hack is like, if you're a beginner aspiring digital nomad and you don't know where you're going to get community from, book a private room in a hostel. So that way it's not like if you're Airbnb, you're kind of by yourself, right? But if you do a private room in a hostel, you got your private room, so you kind of got some privacy, but you're like surrounded by travelers, and being surrounded by travelers, especially early in your journey, is good because it starts to make it seem relatable. And they're not all backpackers. Like you go to a hostel, there's really not all broke backpackers. There are digital nomads. There are people that are they're like people with all these different stories, right? So I think a private room in a hostel is actually pretty underrated. It's often a lot cheaper than a hotel, and you get like some built-in like people to hang out with. And usually there's tours and stuff. For example, like if you go to this is a random thing, but a lot of the hostels have relationships with the big nightclubs. And so you'll get like, if you book a hostel and the hostel's whatever, private room, $45 a night, and then you'll get like free entry and a free shot to a nightclub that would have otherwise cost you like $20 to get in and have a beer or whatever. So it like almost pays for itself just on that. And then they have all these other events, whether it be like tours that go around the city, like the sightseeing bus or the walking tour or discounts on scuba diving, whatever. So you get like all these like tours and activities built into. So it's a good way to start for a lot of people.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think Salina, if it's in a place, I mean, they're in pretty popular cities for nomads, but that is a really awesome one and really nice too. They'll have co-working and just like to the nines in terms of hostels. So yep. I'm curious, just from a conversational level, your partner is not from your home country, is from a different country, as is mine. And I'm curious, did you meet them throughout this lifestyle somewhere along the way? What has that looked like in terms of actually having a romantic relationship?
I will say one thing though, is actually like a lot of people along the way have met my girlfriend and stuff. So like in the past year or whatever in different countries. So she'll travel with me, and I think like traveling as a couple is fun too. And I guess that's your vibe these days for the most part.
That has actually always been my vibe, and not on purpose, not intentional at all. My partner and I, we met in China when we both lived there. And then I never really solo traveled. So that's why I don't really speak on solo travel, especially solo female travel that much, because it's not really something that I know about. But
right.
The reason I ask is because in terms of community, I find, and I know some other single solo female nomads or expats, and it's a lot different when you're traveling with a couple versus when you're traveling alone, because it's so, and I think that's, you know, why you said I never feel lonely. Neither do I. But a lot of women that I speak to, and I'm sure you could probably speak more to men, they feel like they do need to be in the party hostel or always be meeting people. Otherwise, they're missing out on everything because they're just sitting at home alone. And so it's a very different vibe, whether you're traveling often or whether you're in a country for 6 months or 1 year and then you leave. Not that I have personally experienced, but I have heard from others who have an opposite perspective that it is a very different lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a couple things I could say to that, but in some ways, I think when you're traveling as a couple, you might actually even be more isolated than an individual, because the individual has to put themselves out there in order to like get things going. Where when you're like an isolated couple, it's pretty easy to just like buy ice cream and go for walks, and like that's the day, right? And you don't necessarily stumble into a lot of adventures. So like it kind of works both ways. Like, you know, one thing I'll see is like, you know, I'm sure you've seen this where you'll just see like three French dudes or German dudes, and they're clearly best friends from home and they're traveling together. And in some ways, that's like the worst way you can do it, because when you're like some trio from your hometown, these guys are going to keep you in your box and you're only going to talk with them. And you're a lot less flexible than if you were a solo traveler. So in some ways, a solo traveler is much more flexible in terms of like interacting with their environment, making new friends. Like if you want someone to talk to, you really got to make friends. You got to put yourself out there. Whereas when I see groups of like three dudes from their hometown, they're just kind of like whispering with each other and like not really like doing anything. And I'm like, man, you're not like, it's not like how it's done. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I think it's important to do like a little, like a well-rounded traveler would do a bit of everything. Like 1 month they're doing solo, 1 month they meet up with the buddies, 1 month they get a girl to tag along with them, right? So I think that's going to be the most well-rounded traveler. And I've kind of done a little bit of everything, I guess, at this point.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you said at the beginning, where in a relationship, it's so easy to just be like, okay, it's just us, so we're going to go for a walk and we're going to go to the store. And then, you know, work takes up a significant portion of the day as well. So yeah, you definitely do have to put yourself out there in regards to that. But I think on a everyday scale, in my opinion, it's been less lonely. But if you want to go out there and actually meet people from that country, you really do have to put yourself out there. And that's where I think, similar to what you said, it sounds like if you're looking for sports groups, you're in Facebook groups and WhatsApp groups. I find WhatsApp groups are so much better because people are really engaged. And now I'm in like a million WhatsApp groups and they're all going off and I'm not even in that country, but I stay there. But yeah, no, this has been really interesting, Vance. So thank you for being here. And where can people find you online?
Sorry, I missed part of that. I'm back.
Yeah, no worries. I was just asking, where can people find you online?
Okay, so we're wrapping up. Okay.
Do you want to say anything, like any last words?
About the yeah, sure. So I guess where you can find us, mylatinlife.com. We are most active on Twitter, without a doubt. X would be twitter.com/mylatinlife. We have the podcast and the YouTube channel, where we're going to be putting out even more traditional YouTube videos, not just the podcast, at the YouTube channel. Again, is My Latin Life. So yeah, if you want to get in touch with us directly, probably the best way is to DM us on Twitter, and we're responding like every day there. But yeah, you know, really, really happy with the opportunity to come on your podcast, the Work, Wealth, and Travel podcast. Nicole, thank you very much for having us.
You've just listened to the Work, Wealth, and Travel podcast. If anything from this episode resonated with you, I would appreciate if you share this podcast on your socials. And of course, be sure to tag me. And don't forget to leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you for joining me on this global citizen journey, and I'll see you in the next episode.